The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
On 17 June, I went down to the White House with the deputy director. They said, is there another snow? And I said, I don't know. I quickly learned that wasn't the answer, right, that they were hoping to hear. So you can never stop someone who's determined, again, has got all the right badges, able to do what has some technical skills. You're not going to ever be 100% secure. The network we're building assumes we have insiders, and we're going to do everything we can to ferret them out. So if you would ask me, is our network secure? I think they're as secure as anybody's networks. Do we potentially have someone inside our networks who's here to conduct malicious activity of one type or another? Chances are we do.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, Special Edition, Part 3, Inside NSA. Yes, Bobby Chesney and I brought a recording device into the Fort Meade complex, so you don't have to do it. Don't try this at home. But we smuggled out data, podcast interviews with five of the agency's senior management team. Our third subject was Lonnie Anderson, the head of the NSA's technology directorate. It's sort of like the IT shop for the people who break into the IT shops of foreign adversaries. We sat down with him to talk about how Snowden did it and what kind of changes he's implementing to make sure the next Snowden can't, or at least that it isn't easy. We talked about the differences between data and the documents Snowden took, about how NSA is moving toward cloud computing, and about how for many NSA workers, the most advanced gadgets they have get left in their cars before they ever come into the building. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Inside NSA, Part 3.
Lonnie, first, thanks for spending time with us today. It's an interesting topic, the technology directorate, and it occurs to me that since I sure didn't know much about what it was and what it did, before we even find out about how you came to be running it, we should probably have you say a few words about what it actually is and what it isn't.
So what is the technology directorate? The technology directorate was created, back in 2008 to put together a bunch of different capabilities from the IT side of the house to support to the business and HR systems to development of kind of our high-performance computing capability to developing analytics. So put together a bunch of technical capabilities that had been split up in the 2000, around calendar year 2000, calendar year 1999. Put those back together so you could create some synergies across those to help the agency do its mission, with an understanding that the cyber field was coming in, what was SIGINT and what was kind of offense and defense, those missions were merging together into more of a cryptologic mission. So how can you create a capability, put together an organization to create capability to support both those missions, which would take more resources if done kind of as one-offs than it would if you put all that back together. So that's what we are. What aren't we? We don't do missions. And our job is to create capabilities to support the mission. It's not to actually accomplish the mission. It's not to conduct SIGINT. It's not to conduct defense or offense or conduct cyber missions. We don't do that.
We sit with those people who do that, the analysts who work those missions, and we make sure that they have the capabilities they need to successfully accomplish their mission set. How big are we? It's an interesting, we're well in excess. We're a three-legged stool. We're government, civilian, government, military, and contractors. We're in excess of 10,000 people across those three fields. We can't do our job, the way we're structured today, we can't do our job without any one of those three legs. It would be impossible. So when you go to media leaks, right, and you there's a lot of calls for, well, we have to limit what contractors can do or contractors' role. I don't think this is a government versus contractor issue. This is one individual.
Why is that? What is it about the contractors in particular that make them indispensable to the mission?
One, their skill set. You see what's going on the outside. You see how fast IT is evolving. You see how capabilities are moving forward. They bring a different skill set to us. At the same time, they bring capabilities against technologies that are long since gone in some areas, and there are people on the outside world who have maintained a capability against those that we don't have. So for technologies that we're no longer kind of producing or no longer developing or spending money bringing into the building, we rely on contractors to keep those systems up and running for us because our user community is still using those capabilities.
So tell us a little bit about your background. How does one come to be the head of the technology directorate at NSA?
Many things come to mind. So when I was hired here in May of 2001, I retired out of the joint staff and came here. I was hired because I had a certain skill set when I was a military operational skill set, did a lot of work with NSA, and the guy who hired me thought I could bring those capabilities or skills to NSA to help with the workforce here. From 2001 to 2008, I had five jobs. So I was a fireman at NSA, right? The boss had a problem. We'll throw him against it. He'll help us put out the fire. Then we'll bring in somebody to actually stabilize it and run it. Different skill sets, that kind of works. He called me into his office in 2008 and said, you're going to the technology director. And I kind of looked around. I'd known him for a while in the military. Like, are you talking to me?
So you're not a tech
I have
job.
A degree in government, a minor in history, at an undergraduate and a graduate level degree in strategic intelligence. So I'm not a technologist. And he said, don't worry about the fact you're not a double E, you're not a computer scientist, you're not a physicist, you're not a mathematician. Don't worry about that. You've got a whole organization full of them. Your job's to get them from point A to point B. It's been fabulous. It's been the best, most rewarding job I've ever had. Literally every single thing that happens at NSA, every single thing that happens at NSA, the technology directorate is involved in. We pay people. We work their HR activities. We build those high-performance computers. We write analytics. If it's happening, we support the IT. If it's happening at NSA, we're in the middle of it. And it's great knowing that your organization is central to everything that we're doing today and that we're trying to get to in the future, which is a move to new technologies, new capabilities to better enable our workforce and the nation as it moves forward.
There's a separate directorate for research. How does that intersect with the technology directorate in terms of building the systems and so forth that you use to meet mission?
Well, so in an ideal world, there's a research organization and a development organization in almost every IT company you go to. You can pick the company. Those are usually separate organizations, and they're separate on purpose so that one doesn't kind of overrun the other. If research were in technology directorate, I might, because of the pressure to support current mission and mission 12 months out, I might be inclined to take some of that talent that's focused on mm-hmm. developing capabilities 5 years out and work the near-term problem. On the other hand, what's critical is that we be so aligned with research, and we do that primarily through our technology director, our tech director, Charlie Bradley, right? So on the technical side of the house, what we try to do is kind of 18 months and in. 18 months to 2 years and in, I own it. It's generally coming from us. We're the production side of the house. We're the guys building it. Research may create a capability that then gets deployed and used operationally, but they're not designed. They're not scoped. They're not resourced to do something on a production scale. So they would probably hand maintenance, operations and maintenance of that capability to us. On the other hand, I need research tied to where we are today. Revolutionary things don't usually go that well. Evolutionary things go much better. So I need research knowing where we are today so that when they're looking on those things 4 and 5 years out, it's something that we can evolve to in kind of a step-by-step and incremental approach, and it works pretty well. Mike and I, Mike Wertheimer, the chief of research, we actually stood up a technology transfer lab, which we based on one that IBM stood up. IBM had the same challenges kind of we do, research doing what it wants to do, technology director or production doing what it wants to do. So they stood up this facility in Albany. We kind of copied that. We've stood up a tech transfer lab here. People from research come in with what they're building. People from the technology directorate come in. We set a finite timeline. We say at X date, you're going to transition that capability to the technology director. They'll go back to their workspace. Research will go back to it. It works pretty well. So it's actually a pretty good, I'm not going to say there's not always tension. There's not tension sometimes, but generally it works very well.
Now, you mentioned that, so you've got this directorate full of double E's and math people and so forth.
And computer scientists.
And computer scientists especially. And I imagine this creates a very distinctive culture, one that maybe is certainly different from your prior career pre-NSA. But I'm wondering both about what your impressions of the science-oriented culture here is and whether your directorate's culture is different from the larger NSA culture. You've been exposed to many parts.
Yeah, that's interesting. So linguists kind of have their own culture, analysts have their own culture, technologists kind of have their own, math guys have their own. Again, the reason the boss brought me here is to get people from point A to point B. So I try to keep people focused on what do we got to do to get to point B. And so far that seems to work pretty well. I don't mess with, I'm not going to be a telecomputer scientist, how to be a computer scientist. I'm not going to tell a guy who's got a degree in physics how to do his or her job or a mathematician. I'm going to say, here's what we need. Here's generally when we need it. You tell me how you're going to deliver that and we'll get along just fine. What can I do to help you be successful doing that? And that's the role I play, I think.
So let's talk about Snowden. You know, you guys do the IT systems for the agency. You must have heard this 1,000 times since June, but we hear it a lot too. People say to us, you know, this is an agency that you have argued, meaning me, you know, we should trust to handle a lot of sensitive data, and it can't stop a 29-year-old or whatever he is from taking out 50,000 documents of its own data and bringing them to China. Why should we, you know, doesn't give me a lot of confidence in its handling of perhaps personal data of mine, leave aside whether it has personal data of yours. What can you tell us about how this happened at a systemic level?
All right. Well, let me address, we don't have personal data on you.
Right? No.
I want to make sure I say that. I had an interesting discussion with my kids after the first Snowden revelations came out. So how does he do what he does? First of all, he arrives. We have a requirement that goes out, that says we need people with the following skill sets, right? A company comes back and says, I've got an individual who meets those skill sets and, oh, by the way, is already cleared. Matter of fact, just updated his clearance and just passed the polygraph. So he's got a TSSCI clearance. This isn't somebody off the street, right? And that's something I think people forget. So we have an internal internet, if you will. We call that our kind of our web world. And all the wiki pages hang off of that web world. On those wiki pages are documents, PowerPoint documents, and Word documents. So that entire area is is kind of TSSCI high, if you will. So it's his clearance high. His badge says you have access to the documents that are on that page, not access to what we would call data. So he's not going into other repositories and getting access to raw SIGINT. He's getting access to finished documents that were produced for one reason, to share, and assuming that you have a TSSCI high clearance. Otherwise, you wouldn't even get on that website. So he was a systems administrator. Part of his job, what we're trying to do is move to an environment where all data is tagged and people are tagged. So you have certain level of clearances. You're authorized to see data, the following types of data. Here's a whole other set of data you're not authorized to see. The world we're moving to, all data is tagged. Here's the authorities that allowed us to collect it. Here's the data it was collected. Here's where it was collected. Here's how we collected it. And then here are the people who, not the people, but the people with the following credentials can see this data. And then you match that person with that data. So a person comes in, oh, you have the credentials, you can see this data. You don't have the credentials, you can't see that data. That's the world we're moving to. Tag data and tag people. Very secure. Once data is tagged, we can track the provenance of that data from the time we ingest it or create it, in the case of a PowerPoint or a Word document, until it leaves our system. So the web world I'm talking to you about was created well before that capability existed. Post 9/11, there's a huge need to share. 70% of our workforce has been hired post 9/11. All they know is share, 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 share. So they create a document, they're sharing it. You have to remember, they're sharing it at a TSSCI site. So you have a top secret SCI clearance, or you're not getting access to that site. So one of the tasks we asked Mr. Snowden to do was take those materials from this untagged and move it to an area where we could actually tag the data and then see who accessed it. So that was kind of, if you will, his cover for action. He was moving. Now, I want you to also know, he was not a ghost, right? It's not like he was so stealthy we didn't see his activities, but it was part of his job description. So the data almost all the data that's been released to date, he didn't need to be a systems administrator to get to. He needed to have a TSSCI high clearance to copy it, because that's why that data is there, for those people to see and to share. So he set up a process. His tactics, techniques, and procedures were pretty simple. And he set up a process that enabled him repeatedly to pull data off the system, using his job to move data from one environment to another to a more secure environment as his cover for doing that. Where I think we were negligent, if we were negligent, where we were is that we did not, we allowed him some form of anonymity as he did that. Someone wasn't watching all of that. So the lesson learned for us is you've got to remove anonymity from the network. Nobody from the director on down can do anything on the network. That's the environment we're moving to. We're not completely there yet, but we're getting there. Can do anything on the network that's not observed, to include a systems administrator. Now, where he did use his systems administrator privileges, we specifically hired him to do those things. So to be a systems administrator, if you will. So he used those to get access to some data that he normally wouldn't have been able to see. But the lion's share of the data he got was because he had a top secret SCI clearance.
Kind of good. Point of clarification: you've been referring to the data available in the web world off these wikis, but if I understand things correctly, we're not talking about here the fruits of collection. We're talking about documents, manuals, procedures.
That's right. I was mentioning earlier, he didn't get access to what we call data.
Right.
He got access to documents.
Right. And this is a really critical distinction, because I think there's a little bit of a narrative out there that, in fact, and if I'm not mistaken, I think he may have represented to some extent. Oh, he could have. He could have opened the files on you and read about your data and found out your information.
He couldn't have.
And that seems like an important distinction to highlight here.
Yeah.
So he has said that he could tap the president if he wanted to, right?
Yeah.
What is the set of things that he could not have done using
either the TSSCI clearance that he had or the super user privileges that he had as a result of being a systems administrator.
Yeah, so where the systems administrator helped him, what he was able to do, what a normal person couldn't do, is he used his system administrator privileges to exfil data. So in that case, he was able to, again, he would move the data as part of the system administrator job to a place where he then was comfortable, from here I can exfil that data. That a normal user would not have been able to do.
And is that the sort of thing that, not being a technology person myself, but I'm thinking that sounds like the sort of thing that also you can tag, you can identify, you can make sure, perhaps even code the data in a way or code the system in a way that you just can't do that without the right authorizations.
Yeah, well, that's the goal, right? That's where we're working to. We've put together a series of activities designed, again, to remove anonymous activity, but also to harden our network to the point where an individual could, you could maybe remove your system from the network one time, but you couldn't re-enter the network without approval to do that. And that would be even a systems administrator. One of the things we're trying to get to is if you want to change, if you're a system administrator and you're going to change code, you're going to update an operating system, you're going to do whatever it is you need to do, on a particular system, is we've set up a process where you have to ask permission or you have to inform somebody, hey, I'm going in to modify the following. You get a Roger. Got that? Go ahead on in. And then when you finish, you log back out that you've done that. Again, to remove anonymous behavior, even from four systems administrators. The people with the most privileges are the people that we're doing the most, kind of we're focusing on most. So we have three tiers of systems administrators, tier one, two, or three, three being the highest. Since Snowden, we've reduced the number of people with privileged access on our networks by over 30%. So we've cut back. Even though we do a lot of in-house development, we've cut back pretty significantly.
Now, one question this suggests is there a risk of overcorrection here? Is there
a risk
the pendulum's going to swing back to sort of a, you know, too far away from the need to share mindset, which had its reasons?
Yeah, so it still has its reasons.
Indeed.
So if you think mission, security, resources, that's the triangle we live in. So how do I, and the goal is to keep those three in balance. So how do I know I'm properly supporting mission, but I'm not negating security, and I'm doing it within the resources I have, right? What's the cost versus benefit? How do I know I'm committing my resources in the right area? That's a huge challenge. We have overcorrected, right? Way overcorrected, and I did that intentionally. So the bosses gave me some pretty clear guidance, and I'm implementing that guidance, and we are way on the side of security now, trying to make sure we don't do that too much to the detriment of mission. But if I'm defaulting anywhere, it's to overemphasizing security. We'll find that balance, right? The pendulum kind of swings both ways. We'll find that balance here in the not too distant future, and we'll be a better, we'll be more secure and better able to support mission as we're going forward. But I've clearly swung the pendulum to support security right now.
So I'm interested in the parameters of that. At a high level of altitude, you've said that you're trying to reduce anonymity, you're trying to reduce the number of people with the highest level cleared access. What else does hardening the network involve at whatever level of altitude you can describe it?
So one of the things we're in the process of doing is moving to a thin client environment. So if you think a thick client you have a CPU under your desk, right? That's a place you can store data. That's a place you can pull data off the network and move it to. If you don't have a CPU under your desk, if you live in a thin client and your CPU is in a data center that you can't get physical access to, that's a huge security improvement.
So hang on, slow this down a little bit for this was pre-explained to us before we started this conversation, but I actually did not understand the terminology until it was, and I suspect some of our listeners may be in the same situation. Back up and explain exactly what a thick and thin client is and why the thin client is a more secure environment.
So if you think of a desktop computer where you have a monitor, you have a keyboard, and you have a CPU, you store data on your CPU. You access data through that central processing unit that's under your desk. That's what you reach to the internet through. The world we begin moving to 3 years ago is instead of every individual having their own CPU under their desk, you can put about 250 people on a CPU on maybe a bigger processing unit, but store it in a data center. So what an individual has is a monitor and a keyboard, and that's it. And the individual, it doesn't reach into what we would call at home our C drive, right? There's no C drive.
So it's a cloud model.
It's a cloud model, and that's what that's the environment we're moving to. If you move to a thin client, you eliminate a CPU or central processing unit under the desk, so there is no hard drive available. Literally, there's no hard drive available to the individual. And then every time the individual accesses, every time the individual logs on, they log into a different, a system back in the data center. Then you eliminate access, physical access to the data center. You've in effect taken someone's ability away, the ability to pull data off of a hard drive away.
Now, was this happening? Is this a reaction to Snowden?
No. We started this in 2011. It's actually, for us, it was the first step towards a move to a wireless environment. Think about our workforce. Think about what you have at home and what the next generation, the school kids of today, have. They have access to more technology. And they leave, our concern is for the new people coming in, or the younger people, I should say. They leave more technology in their car than what we expose them to here at the workplace. With the exception of the people who work in the high performance computing, right? That's literally Toys R Us. But for the younger generation, what they've grown to is just a laptop or a notebook that they can get up and walk around and create communities of interest with other analysts or whoever they happen to be working with, and that's the environment we're trying to build for them here. Just like Apple or just like Android, we're creating apps they can use to download their data or to analyze their data. We're trying to create the same environment they'd see on the outside.
Except that they won't have access. They will have access to the data, but they won't have the data on their devices.
That's exactly right. No data on their device. The data resides in the data center. The only thing they'll have on their device is the screenshot, right? So what's ever on the screen, and then you get to
what's... And I assume there's no thumb drive access to the...
Well, we can disable thumb drives. Every device today comes... You can't go to the store and buy a device without a thumb drive. So, again, I'm not a technologist, so my simple answer, and these guys dissuaded me, was glue them all. Right? I'm pretty easy. You just go to Home Depot, you buy glue, you glue all the USB ports. You really don't want to do that. And they walked me off that cliff. Except for a certain number of machines, we disable all those USB ports.
So this has, in large part, been a conversation about counterintelligence, and in more particular than that, about the technical means of advancing the counterintelligence mission in this delicate internal security context. Of course, counterintelligence is more than just the technical means of doing that. It's also about the culture of a place. Can you say a little bit about what it's been like in this post-June era in terms of trying to get people to be more actively aware, if you will, of these sorts of
yeah,
risks?
So that's a huge challenge. And it goes back to, I think you made a comment earlier, and I probably didn't answer it. We can't go back to pre-9/11 need to know. We can go back to a need to know if it's broader than what it was. So how do we take what turned into a need to share and combine that with a need to know and make sure people only see access to data they're authorized to see? In my mind, that goes back to tagging the people and tagging the data. Once I put a tag on a piece of data, and it can be, again, data we ingest, we collect, or it can be a document we produce, then I can track that document or that data from the time it's created or it's ingested until it leaves the system. And I see who's accessed it, and then I can see what they've done with it. That's the environment we're moving to. Ironically, it's the environment we're moving to way before Snowden. Thin client, right, is the environment we're moving to way before Snowden. We've been on a path to enhance security and make our move to the cloud, make the data more shareable, more discoverable. For the entire time I've been in the technology directorate, we dramatically picked that up in 2010. we just weren't finished, right? So he was, unfortunately for us, he was a few years ahead of where we would have liked him. That said, since June, people ask me all the time, what's the morale like? Well, the morale's surprisingly, it's very good. Why? Because they see, you know, you can either be a victim, you can sit and go, well, this sucks, and feel sorry for yourselves, or you can kind of roll your sleeves up and make things better. And our whole approach has been, all right, this happened. Now we're going to fix it. And I think that's the approach we've taken, not only across the directorate, but across the agency. The people in Hawaii are particularly hard hit. So I've visited them twice. He sat next to them. They helped him become a better systems administrator. They helped him write script. They helped him learn how to use, the tools he used against us. And why did they do that? They did that because they thought one of them. He was a guy hired to be a systems administrator, and if he can't do his job, they have to do it. Right? So they were doing what all of us do, which is if a guy's going to do it, let's make sure he or she can do what they're supposed to do. I tell them all the time, Snowden could have happened anywhere. He could have happened here. He could have happened at any other place at NSA. He could have happened at any place in the IC. And it could have happened any place across the government.
How confident are you that after these changes are made, a Snowden couldn't happen?
Yeah, so that's great. On 17 June, I went down to the White House with the deputy director. They said, is there another Snowden? And I said, I don't know. I quickly learned that wasn't the answer, right, that they were hoping to hear.
That didn't satisfy him. That wasn't reassuring for him.
But you know, you can – he said in one of his interviews, he came to Hawaii to do what he did. So you can never stop someone who's determined, again, has got all the right badges, able to do what has some technical skills. You're not going to ever be 100% secure. The network we're building assumes we have insiders, right? We're just going to assume we have those people inside our networks, and we're going to do everything we can to ferret them out. So if you would ask me, are our networks secure? I think they're as secure as anybody's networks. Do we potentially have someone inside our networks who's here to conduct malicious activity of one type or another? Chances are we do. And we're going to do our best to find that individual. It goes back to removing anonymity, and you do that by tagging people and tagging data.
One question that's just coming to mind for me, let's just hypothesize that we've got a genuine whistleblower type situation. Somebody's really got a legitimate complaint about something. As we move towards this far less anonymous environment, does it crowd out the possibility for genuine whistleblowing?
Yeah, so no, but I want to address that kind of head on. He was not a whistleblower. He never talked to his supervisor. He never talked to a peer. He never talked to he could have gone to the general counsel. He could have gone to the IG. He never talked to anybody about his concerns. He could have done that. And we actually have processes, if you want to be a whistleblower, that are in place. He never mentioned in the polygraph that he took 30 days before he arrived. Hey, just so you know, I've got some concerns. He never mentioned in his security update that was completed a couple of months before that he had some concerns. He never mentioned it at all until it appeared on 5 June, right? And then all of a sudden, I'm a whistleblower. He wasn't a whistleblower. He's not a whistleblower today. He wasn't a whistleblower then. Yeah, those processes are in place.
But you don't see this tightening as potentially constricting the legitimate whistleblower.
No. As a matter of fact, that we've had that discussion. So one of the things we've talked about, and Sally and security and I have been in multiple discussions, is what we don't want to do is make things so tight that we create a potential Snowden, or Snowden-like individual. So we've been pretty clear in the documentation we've sent out, in the And Sally sends out agency alls. I send out agency alls, where we say, from this date on, here's kind of the activity that's not going to be tolerated. And we're not saying in the past if you did this, because somebody, you know, things happen. I get things happen. And it's not a black and white. If something happens and we've had individuals instances since 5 June where activities have taken place and we said, time out. What are you doing? And the individual's been able to explain it. And we said, okay, that makes sense. So no, we're, as a matter of fact, post Snowden, we published, if you are concerned and want to be a whistleblower, here's how to do it. So we've actually published that in NSA All. So no, I think we're bending over backwards to do the right thing here.
So one of your other functions is imagining future directions of technology and their integration into the agency's day-to-day function. And I can't imagine trying to stay ahead of technological trends in this world. And I'm, you know, this is a non-Snowden related question, but how do you even think about that as a project? And you know, if you have the head of information at an organization that has to be enough ahead of technology to spy on it, how do you do that?
Yeah, so that's a great question, especially when you've got a guy who's got a degree in government and poli-sci running it. So I don't know that we're ahead. IBM spends more on research than NSA's budget. Google and Facebook spend more than our budget. So I think our job is to see what's coming and try to stay at that crest, and be flexible enough, as we build the system, so as technology shifts left or right, we're able to shift left or right with it. I don't know that we get ahead of it, but as we see where industry's going, we don't put all our eggs in one basket for one thing. We try to leverage, that gets back to the research angle. We try to leverage research and our partners in industry. Where are they going and what are they doing? Where do they see us needing to be in a few years? And then make smart decisions going forward. But we also don't operate on a 5-year plan, right? We don't decide something today that we're going to deliver in 5 years, except in a very few instances. We're flexible enough where if 2 years down the road, this isn't working, we'll adjust it. And that in-house flexibility kind of helps us. Unlike the rest of the government, we do a lot of in-house development. We have a lot of developers, probably more than the rest of the IC, the rest of DOD, and the rest of the government combined. So that gives us some flexibility with industry, whereas when they go out and they write a requirement, and industry builds X, whatever X happens to be.
Like a healthcare website.
Like a healthcare website. Like think of the four kids at Stanford who over the course of a weekend said, here's, let us help you explain what that healthcare website is. So I think we've got an advantage on some other.
But talk to me about that healthcare website. I mean, not what HHS had to do, but in
we had nothing to do with it.
I understand.
maybe that's the problem.
Somehow, like, I think if you guys had something to do with it,
for the record, I'd like.
if you had, I mean, you guys must get assignments all the time to do complex data integrations, and unlike HHS in that context, you develop it yourself, or some significant
component. In concert with industry.
Right. I mean, what that, as you say, is really different from the rest of the government.
Really different.
Just talk about that a little bit. I mean, this is, among other things, a major development engine for a certain groups of categories of technologies, and that does seem really different from how HHS thinks about a problem like, what do you do with everybody's healthcare data to get people insurance?
Well, if you think that their HHS's mission isn't technology.
I understand.
The national security's mission is pretty much IT. If we don't have an in-house capability, we can't have the flexibility we need to successfully complete our mission for the nation. Right? So outsourcing all technology development was never an option for NSA. It would have put us into that 5-year model. Everything would have been an acquisition project. Everything would have had a, you know, a phase A, phase B, phase C. Here's where we added FOC. That wouldn't work. Not in the mission that we're challenged to do. And in the world of cyber, that's coming at us, everything is moving more and more towards a real-time environment. So you need more flexibility, not less. So having the ability in-house to pretty quickly take a couple of highly talented people and put them on a project and say, I need something. It doesn't need to be a perfect solution, but we need something quickly. We're unique in our ability to do that.
There's a lot of innovation embedded in what you're describing. Lots of new things being created. It begins to call to mind something like the discussions that surround NASA. And the idea was the government's putting a lot of money into these aerospace programs, and there's a trickle-out effect, and there's a larger economic benefit. Things eventually benefit all of society. Tang, what have you. Is there something similar that takes place with NSA's technology?
Oh, there sure is, but I'm going to use your NASA. NASA created a utility cloud maybe 4 years ago. They created their own kind of version of a utility cloud. They open source that and sent it out in the Apache world for other people to help them with that. So their cloud was called Nebula. And I think that's unclassified. So theirs is called Nebula. And then they sent it out to the Apache community. It came back as something called OpenStack. So a lot of talent on the outside, a lot of computer scientists looked at that and said, hey, that's pretty good. But if you did this, it would be better. If you did that, it would be better. Well, we adopted that. That's our utility cloud. We didn't recreate the utility. We didn't need to. So it's a lot like Amazon's EC2. Right, it has a lot of technical underpinnings that were developed by the open source community, and we just adopted that and are using that today as our utility cloud. So one, we've open sourced. We wrote some security software for the cloud. Now, basically, we took Google's cloud and put a security wrapper over it. We open sourced that. It's called Acumula. The open source community is helping us make that stronger. And we also adopt on the other side of the house. So we're trying to leverage. We know there's a lot of talent out there. We're doing what we can to leverage it.
And how, at the end of the day, how dependent are you guys on industry for your own development? How much of it's internal? How much of it's external?
Oh, yeah. I think it's. I don't want to underestimate the role of industry. We rely on them heavily. I don't know what percentage-wise, probably most of the development is external. We keep some things that we think are government kind of only, and we do those. The rest of the stuff we give out to industry, even stuff that we will maybe do some of the initial development on for long-term production kind of scale, we give it to industry and ask them to help with us. But it's a close partnership. Again, we couldn't do what we do without industry.
Thanks very much for joining
us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, it's Inside NSA Part 4. Bobby and I talk to Anne Neuberger, who manages NSA's relationships with the U.S. private sector. You think you have a hard job? She's got to deal every day with angry tech companies who, for some reason, don't seem to like it that her agency makes them turn over their clients' data and then can't keep their cooperation secret. The Lawfare podcast is produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. That's her right now. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.